Is that working?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I know what's going on. It's because I'm doing. Yeah. Okay. No, that's right. Yep. Left, right, start. There we go.
I've got my hot filter on.
Oh, this might actually be me. This might actually be my bed.
Oh no.
The hot filter.
And so it begins.
It's always my fault.
Damn it, Wadman, you had one job.
Did I tell you the other day when we spoke, did I tell you that I broke the door on my camera, the battery door?
Yes. Yeah, because there was some sort of 3D printing involved.
Well, yes. So I've had my Pentax for what, 27, 29 years or so now at this point? Like, not even kidding.
It used to have a pull starter on it, but they've updated it to battery.
You know, I was thinking about that the other day. Do you remember? Well, of course you do. You remember 3-2-1 contact?
Yeah.
Okay, 3-2-1 contact.
Yeah, yeah. And they have to put the one leg up in the air and then, whoom, you know.
Yeah, but that was a TV show in the 70s for kids, right? There was also a TV show which referenced that. But I think they're referencing, like actually spinning the propeller to get the engine going.
Yeah.
Which is a reference that no one would understand under the age of 50.
Right. If you want to see it in action, go rent The Great Waldo Pepper with Robert Redford.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He's a pilot. We've come home from the war, and now he charges people to fly up in his biplane.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I've never but it's Redford. That. So come on.
But yeah, yes, I've had the camera forever, and I like, you know, it's my little baby, you know?
Okay. I don't think you told me how, you told me that it broke, okay. But I don't think you told me how you
Okay. So it's got like one of those, flip up and rotate sort of, you flip up this little tab and you rotate it and these little pins come out from the sides to keep it closed when you keep it closed. Does that make sense?
The screen.
No. I'm talking about the battery door.
Okay.
So I unhook it and then I pop the battery out sometimes if I go to charge the battery. And sometimes I will just like put the camera body just like down in the hole in the case where it normally is, not down where the battery door is facing down, but just sort of like stick it in there sideways just to like have somewhere to put it.
Right. Right.
And usually I close the battery door. I'm not a complete idiot.
Oh,
hold for laughs.
And, hold on. Wait a minute. Oh,
so I put it down. Oh God. I put it down. And then I think what I did was I came back like hours later and being all of 51, I forget things
You'd
now.
You'd forgotten. Oh, you forgot how you put it in.
And I just sort of like flipped it downwards and then closed the top.
Yeah. Snap.
Yeah, and so I didn't realize it until I pulled it out the next time, and the part of the door that was on the hinge that was still connected to the camera is still connected to the body, and I'm like,
oh, so it wasn't just that it came off;
it snapped in half.
Oh wow!
If it came off, I would have figured out a way to put it back on, but it was like part of it was on and part of it was off. Now. Normally, a lot of cameras, I remember with my Canon, I don't know if any camera you've ever had, the bottom door often comes off to put a battery grip on.
Yeah. There's like a function. It's usually almost like a little compression, like a shower curtain rod, where it just compresses in and you can pull it off.
Yep. 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 Apparently, this camera, no, they don't do it that way. You have to... take I found a service manual for the K7, which is the high end or one of the SLRs that they make that uses the same door. Cause I could not find, I could not find the mechanism, the thing for my camera. So I was just like, oh, let me use this one.
Yeah.
So I look through and I'm like, okay, so how does this door come off? There's got to be a way to come off. And then you look through the diagrams, these like, you know, diagrams that look like something out of Apollo, you know, spaceship diagrams, you know, where it's like 73.
Make sure the O2 level is set to 40% before proceeding.
Yes, that's exactly what it felt like. And I was like, oh, Jesus Christ. So I'm looking at the
bottom. Is it because of the weather sealing or something? Is that why it's so complex?
I don't know, but like it's completely different than my camera and this camera were completely different, I think, other than the fact that they use the same door mechanism. Yeah, this camera is kind of like a giant 35mm SLR. It's kind of like what I like about it because it feels like a 35mm SLR, except it's got this big honking sensor, right?
Right.
So I look, and according to this, you have to take the entire bottom off the camera to get to there because that pin doesn't come off the way you're talking about, the shower rod thing. So I get the thing.
Wait, so you took it apart?
Well, I tried to. So I get out my little iFixit toolkit, and I was like, I'm smart. I'm 51 years old. I have experience in this world.
Age does not always equal wisdom, kids.
Yeah. So I pull out the thing, and I get the bottom, and I get the thing, and I find the right tip, and I pulled out, Jeffrey, swear to God, 14 screws out of the bottom.
Just to get to the door.
No, I pulled out 14 screws and absolutely nothing happened. The thing was still a giant brick that nothing felt like it was like loosening.
Oh, wow.
I think you may have to take the camera apart from the top down to get to the base plate.
But you live in New York City. Is there not a Pentax service center that you could bring that in and go, hey, take 5 minutes and fix this, would you please?
Okay, so I looked in before I decided to take the whole thing apart because I figured if I can get the part of the door that's on here off, I could then take those two parts and maybe in situ, like non in situ, like separated, do a nice clean on a table super glue thing of the two of them.
Sure, sure.
Like if I could isolate them.
Yeah. I mean? It may not be pretty, but it would be functional. Yep. Yeah, sure.
So I've simultaneous tracks going. One is this, I'm going to fix it as it is. The other one, I called Dan Gottesman, my friend Dan Gottesman.
Bill's got a loop in his head going, I'm 51, I can fix it. I'm 51, I can fix it.
Yes. God damn it, I will fix it. So,
which is irrelevant to experience or knowledge. Yes, it's just a thing. We all do it.
Like,
I do it.
I have it's like the $7 million man. Like, we have the technology, right?
Yeah.
So a while back, Dan 3D printed me one of these brackets for the back of my studio display so the laptop can just slip down behind the studio display.
Oh, right.
So my laptop just kind of sits vertically behind my studio display. And it's awesome because it keeps the stupid thing off the desk because I don't use the monitor on the laptop. Anyway, I just use it as sort of a laptop desktop kind of situation.
Yep.
So he made this thing for me. So I was like, oh, well, Dan knows how to do 3D printing stuff and he's my friend. So I text Dan and I say, hey, would this be possible to make? And he's like, maybe, yeah, but it's like, you know, it's not a box. You know what I mean? Like, it's got curves and, you know what I mean? Like,
but Bill's like, yeah, but I have calipers.
Well, that would be Dan would say that, but yes. But the closing, the locking mechanism that I talked about initially, that comes off. So you could conceivably like take that off. In that part, because you couldn't like 3D print this whole mechanism. Well, you could, I'm sure, but like I'm not going to. I just need like sort of the base plate that it sat on. So Dan's like, yeah, maybe we could do that. So that's track number two. Track number three is let's find another one of these effing doors somewhere on the internet, you know.
Yeah, but you still have to get the other one off, which you haven't done at this
exactly.
point, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Okay.
So I start looking online, and there's one place, they don't make parts for this thing anymore because this camera's from 2014.
Right.
So so I look and there's this place called USA Camera or something that has the part, Jeffrey.
It has the door mechanism.
It has the door itself, not the
locking.
Not the locking part.
Mechanism.
Except it's not available. Sold out. But it's listed. Now I have a part number.
Right.
So then I'm going through the internet and I even asked, you know. I asked Claude, I think, I'm like, can you find me one of these on the internet? Like, does this exist? And it came back and it's like, yeah, I found one here on USA Camera. And I was like,
the same one that you have.
Yeah. And I was like, no, listed. I think it's out of stock. And then it goes, wow, you really are 51 and smart. It's out of stock.
Did it really say that?
Yeah, basically. It did.
Wouldn't that be great?
But you know how they're like sycophantic that way?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, what a great idea. Yeah. You know, I'm thinking about building a nuclear reactor in my bathtub.
That's a fantastic idea,
Bill.
So I can't get a new one. Dan says it's really hard to 3D print one. And so but I want to use the camera. Now, the camera still works with the door broken.
Right.
Which is great. Which is like, okay, if I had to, I could still just continue to use the camera.
Okay. Is the battery compartment itself sealed from the rest of the camera? Or do you risk introducing dust onto the sensor because you're not using the door over the battery?
Maybe.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, but it's a SLR camera. Dust is getting in there anyway whenever I change lenses. You know what I mean? But the thing that holds the battery, and there's like a little, you know, thing that like a little, like, you know, one of those little springy things that holds the battery in. So it's not like the battery's going to fall out or I need to use duct tape. I'm just going to have the part that can't come off apparently until I take the whole camera apart is still going to be like hanging off the bottom, like cutting the bottom of my hand or something.
In the ghetto.
In the ghetto. So I decide to say, you know what? I'm going to give it a shot super gluing this thing in situ as it is on the camera.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
And so, but you know with super glue, you've super glued a thing or two in your life.
Mostly my fingers, but yes.
Yeah. And so, you know, you get one shot, kind of. You know what I mean? Like, you don't.
Yeah.
So if it, and for it to really work, it has to be aligned really as perfectly as possible.
Yeah, if there are any gaps, you can't depend on the glue to fill the gap.
Exactly. Although apparently I learned a little trick, which is if you have it separated, I'm not going to do this while it's on my camera, but if you pour baking soda onto wet super glue, like when you first connect it, you just dump baking soda on it, it fills in the cracks and hardens like steel.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right.
And then you can blow it. It's not pretty, but it apparently like really works. So I couldn't do that. So I'd line it up and it looks like it fits together. You know, so when you get two plastic pieces and you fit them together and it kind of like feels right. You're like, oh yeah, that's actually not bad the way it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
how
the hell do I get it back there after I put the glue on, you know? So I got it next to me. I got like a strip of artist tape. And
I'm picturing you wearing one of those like magnifying glass headpieces.
I got the magnifying headpiece, and then I've got the big giant magnifying glass on like an arm.
And you've got your sleeves rolled up with the little braces.
Oh, I've got a lab coat on.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, yeah.
So I line it up and I tape it closed so that I can flap it open. But when I close it, it's aligned. You know what I mean? Like,
Okay.
The tape does the thing. So I watched a YouTube video and apparently it says that if you put a little bit of super glue on one side, just like a little coating and let it dry, that wet super glue bonds to hard super glue better than it bonds to plastic.
Huh.
So that like
so you create a little skin first.
Exactly. On one and then side. And then you put the wet stuff on the other side and you put it together and, you know, like, you know, strong like bull.
Yeah.
So what's that from?
Oh, my God. What is it from?
What is strong like
Deep Cut from a movie, isn't it? Oh, is that the timer?
Yes.
Oh.
Sorry, I have a new digital piano next to me. I can do these things.
Bill called me the other day, and he's like, hey, I bought a new piano. What was the first thing you played? Come on, give it to me. Those of you who have been here for a while will see the funny in that. Those of you who haven't have moved on.
Yeah, move on.
You're listening to something else already.
So I get the super glue and I put it on one side and it dries. And then it's sort of like the moment of truth, right? So I put it on the other side. I try to get it nice and wet. And then I go, oh, 3, 2, 1, F it. Poof, and I like lock it, right?
You lock the battery door down.
No. Oh, no. I straighten it all out. But then I also, what I did was, before I straightened it out, I had a penny halfway on one side. And then so when I closed, the penny ended up being like a thing that stopped it from going too far that direction. You know what I mean? Like a splint.
But then you glued the penny to the battery.
No. The moral of the story is that it worked.
It worked.
I let
because
sit-
you, when you called me, you were like, "Oh my God, do I buy a new camera? Is there any reason to buy a new camera?
Well,
should I even buy a new camera?"
This is where I was going.
I felt like
this.
I was talking to myself.
So it is true that like ultimately my wife, who loves me, was just like, you know, use that camera. You've used it for 16 years. Like, there's one on B&H that has like 1,000 actuations for $2,300 or something like that. Like,
right.
Let's just get it. You know,
because you've got glass, right? So
yeah, I've got all the lenses, and then worst case scenario, I have just a backup body from the old one. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, if you know.
Wait, so did you buy it in the interim? Because we haven't spoken since then.
No, I didn't buy it because this is where we get down to the: is it worth buying a new camera? Because
I don't know. Is it? I mean, is anybody looking? If it still works, okay. Let's break this down. Let's. Yeah. Break it down for me, fellas. If it's still working, was that a beat? Is anybody going to care other than you? And does it impede you from doing your work to have it slightly wonky looking if it's functional and doesn't inhibit the performance of the camera?
Well, can we also add into the fact that I still have the Fuji?
Oh, right. Oh,
so I've got a
right.
whole other camera system.
Yeah, you've got the GF100X.
And yeah. I last year I bought another lens for it. I bought the 55 1.7, which is a pretty nice piece of glass. The glass is all very nice. I just still don't like using the camera. But the lens is beautiful. So yeah, I have.
So it's not like you need new hardware to do your job.
No, it's not like, oh my God, if you get a shoot tomorrow, like, what are you going to do? It's just like, I don't know. I don't have access to a camera, you know?
Yeah.
But it is, you know, the investment nowadays in buying a new camera, like, does the market, like, who's buying new cameras now?
I don't know. It seems like I'm out of the loop. I'll be honest with you. I'm really out of the loop.
Yeah.
But it seems like compact is king again. That people are going to, you know, they're fawning over the X100. Was it six?
Six.
Seven? Five? Seven, six.
IV.
X,
v,
IV.
VI.
VI. X106. Ricoh has a new pocketable, you know, 40 megapixel thing.
Yeah, one of those little guys.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the cyclical thing, like everybody was talking full frame and then everybody was talking about medium format. And now we're back to, I want to carry it in my pocket.
Yeah.
The
Gen
does
Z
it
kids,
even matter?
They're using digicams from 2002.
I've heard about that too. Or they're going back to film.
Little digital elf. Yeah. Or
yeah.
Film.
Yeah. Yeah. Going back to everybody's carrying around like the Olympus XA or something, you know?
Who are these kids? What are they doing?
I don't know. Kids with money if they're carrying around film cameras.
Well, that's the other thing. Like, even if you were to shoot film. So my speaking of new cameras, whatever, is my mother-in-law gave me a 1915 Brownie 3A Kodak.
Oh, wow.
For my birthday this year.
Wow.
And it was very sweet of her. Sorry. There we go. It was very sweet of her. And here's the crazy thing about it, though, is that, you know, it uses... Oh, crap. It's not 620 film. It's like 920 film or something.
Hmm.
It uses a film that they don't make anymore. And not just like it's real close to 110 or 120. It's just like a little bit bigger. It's like, no, it's a third bigger than 120 film.
Hmm.
But they don't make it anymore. You can't even get stuff to make it anymore. But people online make like 3D, speaking of 3D printed, 3D printed adapters so you can stick 120. You can basically stick a 120 roll in it, but it only covers like the lower two-thirds of where it would cover.
Yeah.
She sent me the adapter kit I got in the mail before I got the camera. So I get this weird box from Etsy in the mail.
Oh, one of these 3D printed things.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, who the hell in my life? Right? Seriously, like who would know
you
my
sounded
address?
A little like George Costanza just then.
Who the hell? who would know what any of this means? Like films,
right.
Like vintage film sizes. Like, And then it turns out Dan was coming over to watch a movie like that weekend. I was like, do you know anything about this? He's like, no. And I'm like, crap. Okay. Well, there's the one guest on my list was Dan. You know, like, right. I don't know who anybody else who like would even think about this kind of stuff. And it turns out it was my mother-in-law who must have learned from the person she bought it from that needed adapters to work. And, you know,
wait, so she bought the thing for you. It's not like she just had it and said, oh, Bill would like this.
No, she bought me this old Brownie 3A, which is this beautiful camera with like bellows that open up and stuff like that. Mm. And it's like original leather outside and it worked. So I ended up using the adapters and fitting film in it and whatever. But, you know, a roll of film now costs almost $20.
Plus, for what, 10 exposures? 10
well,
shots?
On that camera, three.
Three shots for $10. Okay.
Yep.
Plus processing.
Plus processing. So you're working at, you know, let's say it's 20 and 20, you're $13 a picture.
However, okay, may I respond?
let's see a try.
It does seem like there is, I don't want to call it a backlash, but a resurgence in all things analog.
Yes.
Right. There does seem to be this digital exhaustion, and people are going back to, you know, carrying analog notebooks and, sure, as we mentioned, using film cameras. And yep. And I can see, I mean, without romanticizing it and sort of fawning over the process, which is sort of my way and to an extent your way.
Sure.
But is part of that a way to back away from all things leading toward AI?
Yeah. Are we trying to find the humanity?
Yeah. Like if I can see your fingerprints on the corner of the negative that you put into, I mean, sure, I guess you could, you know, the cynical side, you could add digital fingerprints to make it look like blah, blah, blah. But
sure.
Is that tactility and that insistence I did this. This wasn't a machine. This sure. wasn't a computer. This wasn't an AI. This wasn't an agent of some sort. This is something that my hand create. Is that some of it? I don't know. I think it is.
I think the interesting thing about that is the idea that this tactile thing is something that technology can't touch.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it's not like if I take pictures with a digital camera and I have a digital camera file, somebody will go, oh, whatever, AI made that file. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Or whatever.
Well, and let's face it. They've gotten so good with faces and detail and skin texture. And it's incredible.
Yesterday, a friend of mine called me and is going to hire me to shoot an album cover for them. They were just like, oh, we know what we want. We made a comp of it in AI. And they sent me this.
So,
image.
So you're just like, can you make this for real? Here's the brief.
Yes, kind of. Wow. Yeah. I mean, like, wow. There's a certain amount of, you know, we're going back and forth about it.
Yeah.
But you know, I will tell you those engines do a really good job of making something super polished looking.
Yeah.
To the point where I don't know that I could make something that polished looking. Certainly not with the budget that I probably have to work with. You know.
Right.
Like
if I
had $100,000 and a team of 12 people, like maybe.
But so are we at a point where the imperfection becomes the perfection? Is that where we're at? Where clean and sharp is and pristine is no longer the goal? Feels like it.
There's been an article in my notes section for a while that I wanted to talk to you about from the New York Times from November. And it's about. The thing is called The Quest for Perfection is Stunting Our Society.
Mm.
And here's one of the paragraphs here, like 10 paragraphs down. This fetishization of perfection might not be surprising, but that doesn't make it any less damaging. You cannot learn or grow while trying to appear as if you have everything figured out. You cannot talk to God by trying to avoid doing something wrong. Perfection is stagnation.
Hmm.
I mean, there is this idea, right? Like where, yeah, we can make stuff perfect now, but like, what's the fun in that? I mean, the past, I don't know, year or whatever it is that all of the sort of features have been in Photoshop. All the new AI features have been in Photoshop. There mm-hmm. are times when it's just like, oh, I need to get rid of, you know, the, I don't know, the light stand was in the shot that I wanted to get rid of. And oh, there's a plant behind it. Oh God, retouching that's going to be a nightmare.
Right.
And you just select the light stand and you say, hey, remove that. And it puts the plant there, you know, or whatever, like the rest of
it. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Like for those things, that's amazing. Yes, that saves me whatever. But most of the time, I kind of want to do that work. Mm-hmm. Like my
well,
job.
Because even if it's not perfect, in quotes, it's you.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the experience of doing it. My job isn't to like put out as many widgets as I can in a matter of hours or whatever. You know, I mean, you and I have talked in the last few months about, you know, you were making some plugins for WordPress, right? Doing Claude Code and whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, and I had fixed a few bugs on my website by using these tools and be like, hey, why is it doing this weird thing? And it's like, well, let me see the code. Let me see the CSS. And it goes, oh, line 54 of your CSS, you need to add this.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, and well, for that's that, fantastic.
Yeah, it is. It's great. It's great.
Yep. But you know, if you were a coder and you were looking forward to sort of solving the problems of putting together the things that you are automating to some extent, would it feel less than? Is it that while you're interested in the computing part of it, you're really interested in the final result of the computing part of it? So it's okay if the machine does a lot of the work?
Well, speaking for myself, I don't have that skill.
Right.
I know a little bit of this stuff. I know enough to sometimes fix what I've broken. But I mean, in the case of these plugins, I mean, we generated 12, 13, 14,000 lines of code.
Yeah. Yeah.
I couldn't have done that if you gave me to the end of time, you know, there's just no way.
Yep.
So in that case, I did it as an experiment. The experiment is now done. Would I do
Frankenstein's monster?
Yeah.
It was just an experiment.
Yeah, they're alive. Would I do it again? I don't know. I don't know that I would do it again because I just wanted to see how it would turn out. And I don't want to be in the business of coding things either for myself or for others.
Yeah.
It feels like it was this little sort of self-contained little microcosm that, okay, I did that. I know, and I've learned enough about it to know that that's not the direction I want to go with my personal or professional energy.
But isn't it amazing though that you needed a tool to do X and you could not find tool Y that could kind of do X the way you wanted? Like you could actually code from scratch the software you specifically needed.
Yeah.
And it didn't cost you $15,000 to have somebody do it.
No, it ended up costing me $20.
Exactly. And that's, but there's a lot of people out there who are CS people who would be like, yeah, like the job I was supposed to. You know,
right.
Or the thing
but
that I found interesting.
Here's the thing. Had it cost me $10,000, I wouldn't have done it.
Right.
So, right. You know, you can't, I don't know that you can say, there's a false sense of equivalency where AI took my job. Well, no, not in this case, because I wouldn't have paid you $10,000 to build
exactly.
four plugins.
Yeah. It's interesting because it is amazing the things that you can. I mean, even as a creative, play around with ideas like these people did with this album cover. It's like, okay, well, if you're trying to explain the album cover to me, this is way better than a terrible sketch with stick figures, you know, to some extent.
Yes. However, it sets up an expectation on their part of what you should, in quotes, be able to produce.
Yes.
Well, if the AI did it at a 9 and you're only giving us a 7.5, then what are we paying you for?
Like exactly.
there's a weird sense of almost digital entitlement that AI creates.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. Sorry. I like digital entitlement.
show title.
Yeah, it's you're totally right, and I think we all kind of get spoiled by that. I call it AI infantilization. You know, it's like we're in this little cocoon of curated knowledge. You know, but there's no exploration. It's just sort of I want this. Nah.
Well, and when you can get close to it, with a few well-constructed, crafted prompts,
yeah,
then it really does tie back to the New York Times article where it's eliminating process. It's yeah. eliminating the tangential sort of aspects of creativity.
And you know, that's where growth comes from to some extent.
Absolutely. I mean, look at, I was watching one of the documentary on the Pink Floyd album covers, right. Storm Thurgeson.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, there are a number, if you showed millennials those album covers, they would probably, many of them would probably assume that they're CG.
Sure.
Or that they're AI, or sure. that they are somehow
especially,
not real.
What's the one with the fire, the guy on fire on the cover?
Yeah, yeah. Wish You Were Here.
Yeah.
You know, but all of those things were done practically. You know, Delicate Sound of Thunder, you've got those two massive sculptures facing each other. Those aren't CG models. They built those out in a field in England. Right, you know, right, there's right, a, right. you know, all of these things that.
Does that make it better?
I don't know that it makes it better. I mean, recently, in fact, I think you and I talked about this a little bit. The new Apple TV promo logo
the glass
teaser
thing, yeah.
sizzler thing.
Yep.
Yeah, they did it all practically with sheets of glass.
But I also heard sort of through the grapevine that the people who did it did a whole bunch of stuff wrong technically with the file formats and all the rest of it, so that people in post had to like jump over backwards to actually make it work in the end.
Okay, that wouldn't that wow. Okay. So
so it's not as clean as people even think it is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The whole idea of like, oh, we're going to actually make this. It's like, yeah, lots of things go wrong.
Yeah.
But to me, though, but even there.
But I would almost rather see the lots of things going wrong.
I understand. Well, certainly. Well, at least then the people who made those two statues out in the middle of nowhere had the experience of doing that.
Yeah. Or, okay, here's another one. Do you remember... years ago, HBO, before like a big feature presentation, they would have that Chrome HBO logo yep. and the camera was moving through the little city and all of yep. that.
Yeah.
All done practically.
I saw a little documentary about it the other day. Yeah.
Is it wonderful?
Oh, it's amazing.
And it's imperfect. And the camera, there's a little staccato motion in the camera and you know, the slit scan stuff around the it's not perfect.
Sure.
But there is something.
Charming?
Yes. Yes. There is something charming about the imperfection, that it's sure. not this perfect, perfect thing. And they had to rehearse and build and rehearse and build and do it in one take and try and get this done. And, you know, there is something about that I find way more impressive than and inspiring, to be honest,
yeah.
than, you know, getting it ever so perfect.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I've decided in the last year to try to make a movie. And so I started a little LLC and I started raising money.
Yeah.
And I raised some of my money, but not all of my money to make my little movie. And I'm not spending a ton of money, like $150,000, which I know is a lot of money, but it's in the movie making business. That's like ultra micro budget.
Yeah. That's craft service money.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 So I am doing it basically like I have friends doing huge favors for me. I have locations that I'm doing it for free. Like, you know, it'll look like a $500,000 movie, even though I'm only spending 150, right? Hopefully if I make it, but you know, I'll tell you, like, it is really hard to justify doing it now because the people I know in that business, like, no one's working. There are the distribution deals people are being offered are less than they were 5 years ago. And, you know, so it's like, great. So what if I make this movie and absolutely nowhere to sell it or whatever? You know what I mean?
Or like, show it or get it out in the world.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, it's like.
So those are very real concerns now.
If 5 years ago I could know that, like, okay, I'll at least make my money back. Even if I put it up on streamers just for pay-per-view and got a little press, I'd probably make $100,000 off it.
Or did a little DVD run or something.
Exactly. Like over time I could make that money back.
Yeah. It might be a long tail, but yeah, you could. There was a model to make that happen.
Yes. And
20
again,
years ago, 10
I'm not
years
even
ago.
Looking to make a whole lot of money. Like, great. If, you know, if suddenly somebody, it was great and people wanted to pay me $5 million for it, super, you know, whatever. But like, I just want to pay back my investors and have the experience of making the thing.
Right.
But now I'm worried about paying back my investors. So I'm like, crap, do I?
I don't want to go to New Jersey for the weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. And but
Bill, come here. We need to talk, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But I still think I could do it. And it's like, well, you know what, Bill? Like, someday you're going to be 81 years old and you're going to be like, why didn't I make that bleeping movie?
Yeah.
When I was 51 years old, even if it is a flop and whatever it is, which I don't think it's going to be, but it's scary. You know,
but what's inspiring for me to hear you talk about it is that you are still looking at the value of the experience and that you are not looking at it as
no, the experience is the only thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And that to me, I mean, you didn't ask for advice, but that to me says you're on the right path. Right.
Yes.
And it's something that I struggle with routinely is putting the things out in the world just because you want to see them out in the world, not because you want some big payday. Some big payday would be nice. It would be great.
Sure.
But every time that I have done a project, and Adrian and I were talking about this, well, we've talked about it a lot lately, but every time I've done a project in the past 15 years, I've made the ROI, right? I've made the monetization front and center, and I've been disappointed, and I let that disappointment in the monetary performance affect how I feel about the creative performance, I feel about the creative end product.
You made an error in the definition of return.
Yes. Yes. Because we have talked many, many times about conflating popular and good and good
you and
popular.
And I?
Wait,
who are
is
you
this?
Again?
Mom?
Hello?
So it is something that it's so easy to lose sight of. It is so easy to lose sight of, I want to do this either just because I want to see the end product or because I want to go through the process of getting to the end product, whatever the end product happens to be.
Right. Yep.
And I stumble on that reality constantly.
But isn't
still.
But let's say you're sitting there and you've got some idea for something, right? And you're just like, oh, I don't know if I should do it because, you know, it might not make the money back or whatever.
Yeah. That's a routine. That conversation is one that I have regularly.
Right. Okay. So let's say that it would take you, it's Tuesday. You'd say, okay, I have this project. It's going to take 3 or 4 days. So I could get it done by the end of the week.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's worth doing. And then the end of the week comes and you actually didn't do much of anything. Wouldn't it have been better just to have done the thing even if it didn't lead to anything?
Wait a minute. Are you in my house? Where are you?
Right behind you, Jeffrey.
The call is coming from inside the house. Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's kind of where I think
that's been the cycle that I have been trying to break via therapy.
Sure.
Is Yeah,
do it
at
anyway.
The end of the week, month, year, and you haven't done those things that you were excited about weeks, months, or years ago,
yep.
And all you've done is burn time.
Let me ask
That's
you a question.
All you've done.
Do you regret doing any of the things you did in the past?
Creatively?
Yeah.
No.
So why do you question your creative output in the future?
You know, it's the stupid lizard brain, you know... you must be paid for work done. You know, it's that thing. And it's nice if you can make it happen, but Jesus, Bill, you and I know so many people now, probably more than we did 5 years ago, who are having to go, yeah, I can't do the thing that I love doing anymore. Yeah. So I have to go do this other thing. I can still keep doing the thing that I love. I just can't make rent doing that thing that I love anymore.
There is a bus in our neighborhood that shows up every few weeks, and it's the knife bus. It's like a, you know, where they sharpen knives, you know, like one of those things. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and a lot of those are like, it's some, you know, 87-year-old Polish guy, you know, who like has been, who is like a foot crank to like get the wheel going, you know,
more coal.
Yeah. This is not that. This is like these younger people who are like hipsters who have this knife truck. And one day I was doing my daily thing last summer and I went by and I was like, hey, do you mind? And the guy's like, yeah, no, of course, you know. And it turns out he was a gaffer for Crudson.
Oh, wow.
He was a movie guy who did a bunch of work with Crudson and like there's no work right now. So him and his friends started sharpening knives.
Wow.
Right. So
what a pivot.
They're really good at sharpening knives and they seem to be doing well, but they're also, you know, sitting in a small painted short bus with grinders in the back for hours a day in the summertime or whatever. Right.
Right.
I mean, it's
right.
not a super pleasant experience, you know, with respirators on and whatever, but like, you're right. Like that's the thing is that like, there's lots of, I ended up at a party, a journalism launch party at, I won't go too much into it, into at the house of a UN delegate.
Was it called The Right Stuff, W-R-I-T-E?
No, but that would be good. That would be a good...
Wouldn't that be cute?
That would be a good idea. And it was just fascinating, like all of the things you and I just said about the world and how it's changing.
Yeah.
This is a room full of journalists, you know, and they're all saying the same kind of stuff, just with different jargon.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like exactly the same conversation. I talked to a guy at Bloomberg who's like the guy at Bloomberg who decides whether a headline is read or not, whether it's like the important headlines to look at kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
This
guy's
like the guy who's at that level where he's like, I have to collect all these stories and like decide which ones are the important ones. He goes, it is so hard to decide which ones are the important ones now because like the world doesn't make any sense right now. What could be the most important thing could also be nothing and vice versa.
It's a blip.
Yep. And it all goes so
fast. And it's
fast.
Not because it's not important. It's because how do you gauge what people are going to be interested in and need to hear, see, read?
Well, what's
going to
have the effect that we think it's going to have.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And these are people who, are, you know, had been in the industry for 30, 40 years. It was fascinating talking to them. And I'm like, and we're also in this beautiful apartment on the Upper East Side, you know, where it's owned by some nation state, you know, or whatever. Like literally owned by a nation state. And it's like, what is going on here? Like everything's just turned upside down, you know? So it's not just us, I guess is what I'm saying.
Is it okay? Not to twist this too much, but is it a phase or is this, will we ever get back to valuing expertise and compassion and empathy and I'm asking for myself because I wrestle with this a lot.
What if those things that we valued before we valued because they were necessary to be valued?
Aren't they still necessary?
Well, maybe they were necessary to be valued for survival, as it were. You know, we have to have the really good person who's the really great blacksmith or whatever, right? You know, the person who can make the best cloth, the person who could, you know.
So we just resign ourselves to live in a world that's good enough, or where good enough is good enough?
Where value is illusory? I don't know. It's like, I don't know. And I think that's what's making everyone so confused.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is that there's no good answer. Cause I mean, as everyone points out, it's just like, if the world ends up the way everyone seems to, or at least like the market seems to think it's going to end up, I don't exactly understand what anybody's going to actually do all day long or how they're going to buy the things that all these people are selling.
Yeah. I mean, we can't just keep passing money around.
Right. Yeah.
At some point, you have
to stop somewhere.
Or
eventually, it's all going to end up in 13 people's pockets.
Right.
And everybody else is just a servant. And then you're talking, French Revolution kind of stuff. I mean, that's what will happen if it goes that far. But it's funny just because it's like, man, it doesn't have to go that far. It's just like greed and... I don't know, but I don't know how you control it. It's a little bit like when they realized in the 1930s that it would be possible to make an atomic bomb.
Mm.
Oh wait, these things keep bumping into each other. They're going to knock more neutrons off, which are going to hold on a second.
Yeah, wait a minute.
That sounds like an explosion, right? You know, And at that point, that one person had that idea. Is it not inevitable that it would someday happen?
Yeah. I guess it is. But have we in this? And again, I keep coming back to the word phase, but maybe it's not a phase. But are we in this phase where we have to disprove the profitability of greed? Or we have not disprove it, because it's already been proven, but do we have to figure out a way to replace that with empathy and compassion and community and those humanity, things that have been on the decline since, in this country anyway, since the late 50s?
Well, right, because really, I mean, on top of all of the things we already said, there's this loneliness epidemic, there's lack of third spaces, there's, you know what I mean, like all of these things that made us connect with one another. Some people say, oh, well, you know, like, let's say X thousands of people listen to us say this right now. Isn't that community? Well, it's like, yeah, kind of. But at the same time, like, it's all so fractured. You know what I mean? That it's not the same. We're not all invested in the same thing anymore. I don't know that we ever were, but at least there was this modicum of consensus.
Yeah, maybe that. Yeah, I could see that.
That. Like everybody, I keep looking around and see, like, okay, so I yelled at a guy the other day at a restaurant. Which,
did you?
Yeah.
Like a server?
Or another patron? I snapped at the server, but about another patron. I am not proud of this. I'm going to tell this story, but I'm not proud of this. I was meeting my wife for dinner at the corner at this other restaurant we go to every once in a while. And I sat down and I'm at the corner. I'm waiting for Conrad to show up. And
wait, so you're sat down at your table, or you're waiting to be seated at the table?
I'm sitting at the table because it was largely empty, but there was this group of, like, I don't know, 30-year-old guys, three of them sitting, having a beer, talking about something. And one of them keeps pulling a little vape pen out of his pocket and sucking on it and putting it back in his pocket. And I can't stand vaping. I think it's disgusting. I think it's disgusting in the same way smoking is disgusting. And you're not supposed to be doing it in a freaking restaurant. It just bothers me.
Was he trying to be stealthy about it? Or
he was trying to be super stealthy about it, which almost makes it even worse.
Yeah. To me. Like, you know what you're doing is wrong, but you're entitled enough to do it anyway.
Exactly. You know, and it's like every time he pulls it out, it like amps up my stress level just that little bit more. I'm like, oh, again, really? Again? You know what I mean? Like that kind of thing. So my wife gets there. She sits down and I said, we may need to leave. She's like, why? It's like, because the guy over there is vaping and it's driving me crazy. And she's like, what are you talking about? You know, and just then the waitress comes over, like, can you please tell that effing guy over there to stop vaping in the restaurant? And she looks over at the guy and she I was like, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to snap at you. I'm just like, really drives me crazy. And she's like, oh yeah. So she goes over and she says, hey, could you not vape in the restaurant, please? And they go, oh, yeah, sure, you know. And then we get our food 15 minutes later, and he pulls the pen out again. And I stand up, and I was like, are you fucking kidding? Sorry, I'll have to bleep that out. Are you bleeping kidding me? And I went around, I was like,
you're going to get in trouble.
I was like, are you kidding me? Can you stop vaping in the freaking restaurant, please?
To the guy. You're standing in front of the guy.
I was like standing right in front of the guy. And he's like, ooh, you know, and like puts it back in his pocket. And at this point, like, I'm all
in some sort of faux surprise, like, oh, I didn't know I wasn't supposed to.
Oh, I'm like, sorry. Like, I'm sorry you're offended. You know, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it ruined the meal for me. I just, like, I was all spun up and I'm all adrenaline even talking about it now. And I know it sounds stupid and small and petty, but like, so the next night we go to a play, this like Noel Coward thing that's at City Center. Anyway,
same guy was there.
This guy sitting right in front of me vaping. No, but the guy in the row in front of me, three over, every 3-4 minutes, turns his phone over, turns it on, checks his email, turns it off.
Yeah.
Turns it on, opens it up, checks his email, turns it
off. So I don't go to the movies anymore.
And I was like,
largely why?
We paid $200 a ticket to see this show. Watch the show.
Not so I can look over your shoulder and see that, you know,
and if it's
homes.com found you a new apartment.
And when it's in your peripheral vision, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's almost more annoying because it's like darkness and then light and then darkness and then light and then darkness.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And So we come back from intermission and I lean over to the guy and I tap him on the shoulder. I said, excuse me, could you not check your email during the show? And he's like, oh, yeah, I can do that. Why do I have to ask you?
Yeah. Why is
right?
And so consideration so, optional. Well, is what we've become.
Exactly. Well, this is where I kind of was going with this, was the idea that, like, it feels like the social contract is broken.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. It's like, can we not smoke in non-smoking restaurants? Can we put our phones away when they asked you to put your phone away at the beginning of the show? Can we all just be here and have a common goal to have a good time, to watch the thing, to eat the meal, to
a
do
shared
whatever
experience?
Yes. And people just can't. And
The last movie I was at, Bill, a guy was shopping for shoes through the movie. Leaned all the way back, phone on full brightness, shopping for sneakers in the row in front of me.
And these events, I know they're like old man yelling at clouds, but they isolate everyone even more. Because now people like you and I don't want to go to the thing.
Yeah. And it takes you out of the experience that you are ostensibly there to have.
Yes, I want to watch the show where Philippa Sue and Rachel Dratch and whoever else is on stage doing a performance for me.
Yeah.
And it's funny because these two, like, you know, middle-aged older women were sitting next to us. And when I did that to the guy, I kind of caught both their eyes on the way back up, and both of them were like rolled their eyes, like, thank you so much for saying something. And I was like,
yeah.
Why didn't you guys say something? Why am I?
Why do I have to? I was just this guy last night. I don't want to be this guy all the time.
But the funny thing is that when we left the restaurant on the way out, and this is where the little version of me comes into it, I had to say something again to the guys and apologize for yelling at them.
Really?
I was like, hey, listen, I'm sorry I snapped at you, but it's a real pet peeve of mine, and I'm having a bad day.
But part of why you were having a bad day is because of their behavior.
Exactly. But I somehow, in my head, felt obligated to say something.
I feel that, though. I feel that.
Because I didn't want to bump into that guy in the street a week later, and he's like, oh, there's the a-hole who yelled at me at the restaurant.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Or the people who own the restaurant, or the waitress thinking, oh, well, I hope that guy doesn't come in who yells at our clientele.
Right. Right. These guys are spending, you know, $400 on drinks and you got an appetizer and a water.
Yeah. Well, the other way around, but yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, and I, again, it's stupid, but it is, it's like this fraying of the edges, you know, kind of.
No, that I think you hit it. I like the way you put it. The social contract has been broken.
Yeah.
Where we have, and maybe we are all casualties of society in this way. And when you feel like no one else cares about you, you have to care more about yourself, maybe, or you have to be more concerned with your own sphere, circle, bubble, and you're not paying attention to the other bubbles. I don't know.
Well, let me ask you a question though. When you and I were young.
Come on, don't you have something queued up on that new fancy keyboard of yours?
Oh, shoot, it turned off while I haven't been playing. When we were younger, it was the .com days, right?
Yep.
You remember the .com days.
I do. I loved them.
And there were people who were our age who were just like, this is putting me out of a job. I can't learn how to code or what, you know, whatever the trope of the day was.
Yeah, that was a real thing then too.
Right. Did you at the time, because I will admit that I did, I was like, whatever, grandpa, like, get out of the way. Like, this is the direction the world is going.
Absolutely. Because I don't want to say you. I was riding my own wave.
Sure.
And you know, it's that scene in Point Break, you know, get off my way, you know, when Keanu tries to drop
Really? Come on. Point Break, that's the reference. Okay, Johnny Utah.
Two. You know, it was that kind of thing where you know, I've slotted into this, I want to ride this wave as long as I can, and if you're trying to drop in, then you're gonna somehow kick me off this wave, and I don't want to be kicked off this wave. So, you know, I was here first, kind of thing.
Yeah, and the world, the world is changing. Either get on board, guy, or get out of the way, because it's, you know.
But now I find myself in the other spot.
Exactly.
I'm the guy trying to drop in on somebody else's wave, and I've got no business being on that wave because I don't understand the underlying forces at work the way that this other person riding the wave is. So it is interesting. It is, maybe that's trying what you were trying to get to.
I mean, the wave is actually an interesting analogy, just because I think that the current wave that everyone is riding is even less understood than the one we were riding.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can see that.
Like, I feel like we kind of knew what was going on with the world, the way the, you know what I mean? The way the internet was changing the world and connecting people and whatever, like that was far more obvious of an end result than what's going on now, which is just, let's just take the entire board and flip it up in the air.
Yeah. Do you think we had more agency then than someone does now in similar situations?
I think that they are on a bigger wave, and I think that they have to ride it even more. They just have to go along with it even more than we did. Does that make sense? Like it's going to sweep them away far more than it just sort of swept us away. I mean, this is in the last year, I did almost all of my work. I had like three editorial gigs in the last year. All my work was commercial work for corporations. Uh-huh. And most of it was like portraits for muckety mucks and, you know, corporate kind of stuff.
Internal or for public facing?
I guess for both, you know, I mean, for like websites and press and that kind of stuff. Like that's.
And the reason I ask is I'm wondering how that market that you've been in that market for a long time and you've done really well, how that market is changing. And are those things still as necessary or relevant maybe as they once were, or is that changing too? Is that becoming another casualty?
I think that over time, the jobs that I've had in the last year were actually pretty good ones, but I think that that is the minority situation. You know what I mean? I think people want more for less. I happen to catch a few where it was like, oh, we need this thing done, and like we don't care about, you know, what, just charge us whatever you need to charge us kind of situation, which is not like I completely gouged them or anything like that, but they weren't just like, we will pay $35 per head to shoot all these portraits, you know. It wasn't like that kind of situation, and so it was okay for me. But but there's so many other people who are doing jobs where it's like, well, there is, you know, this isn't where we're at now. You know what I mean? Like we're going to use a bunch of pictures and like a lot of startups and stuff are doing the thing where they grab a bunch of baby pictures of people and then make AI versions of them. You know what I mean? All looking the same or whatever for the website. We're not even going to photograph people. We're just going to use the picture you took at the bar the other night and cut it out and stick it on white or whatever.
And call it candid, or it's a stylistic choice
Sure. Yeah, like that. Yeah, and I mean, I don't blame them, you know. It's not interesting to me from the kind of work that I want to do. I also got asked this year to do a guy that I knew had a bar and it was closing after like 15 years. And so he had me come in, and it was like 10 of his friends came in. And we made like a big sort of group shot of them, sort of like some of them were bartending, some of them were drinking, some of them were passed out, some of them were against the wall kissing.
Cool.
Like it was like, you know, this what's that? I forget.
You do it all at once or did you?
No, I shot it all. I locked it down on a tripod and then I moved the lights around for each person and then did plates and then comped it together.
Cool.
Yeah, it was cool and it was fun and it came out really good. But, you know, I didn't charge him what I would have. I wanted to do it just because it was like, oh, finally a fun gig.
Yeah.
You know, did I charge him how much time it took me to do it?
No. Been such a big fan of assemblages like that. You've always been that way. Well, since I've known you anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're fun and I don't get to do them that often. So it was kind of like, okay, do I still have this muscle? You know? And it worked out.
Do
and
you
it, it
do you see good. This cyclical, or do you see this as this is the way it is, period?
Like, is it going to go back somehow?
Yeah. Yeah. Will there be, like we were talking at the top about the sort of analog backlash? Do you see, or is it has that chapter been, we're past that now and we can't go back?
I think we're past it and can't go back unless you happen to, I mean, I'm sure there are people at the high end who can still make good money, but not the kind of money they were making before.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, I think that's gone. You know, it's sometimes you see on stupid social media things, you're like, can't believe this photographer wants to charge me $1,000 to do this. $1,000, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, says the lawyer who makes $3,000 an hour, you know, or whatever.
Yeah, right.
It's like, yeah, it's expensive. You know, my assistants cost me $600 a day.
Yeah.
Like, so, you know, if you say you want to pay me $1,200 to do a gig, I'm giving half the money to my assistant.
And then the other, you're accounting.
Yes.
Know,
oh, yeah.
Taxes.
Yeah. All of that.
Insurance.
So, you know, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, shoot. You know what? You're right. Sorry, insurance. I was just thinking with the Pentax, I don't have that camera insured right now, or else maybe I could have argued that it was destroyed. But yeah, all of those things. And it's sort of like, well, I'm sorry. For me to actually walk out the door and actually have a profit, I got to charge you $1,500.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Whatever it is.
Some people are like, $1,500? I thought it was going to be $150. It's like, it cost you $150 to fill your gas tank. You think I'm going to come all the way to you and do this job?
But that's that weird sort of economy of technology, you know, that we were talking about earlier with, you know, $10,000 for these plugins or $20 in a month of your time.
Everything should get cheaper over time. Somebody was bitching about their computer the other day. They had a really old computer. And I was thinking, you know, you could Mac Minis now, you can get them on sale for $500. For $750, you can get a MacBook of an M4 Air, which will literally cut 4K HD raw video, you know, 4K raw video.
Yeah. And remind me again, how much was that Apple IIe back in 1985?
Well, in 1985.
Like $4,700?
Right. Yeah. In 1985 money.
Yeah.
The original Mac was, what, $2,500 in 1984, which has got to be at least $12,000 now, right?
Yeah.
But interestingly enough, I paid for I'm still using an M1 Max with 64 gigs of RAM. So like it's a pretty topped out, you know, laptop from 5 years ago. And it's still fine. Like maybe next year when they come out with the new design cases, I'll get a new one or whatever. But it cost me, I think, $3,600. I spec'd out whatever the current one is, the M4 Max, with the same specs, and it was $4,800. It was $1,200 more now than it was 5 years ago. So like prices for some things are going up, but it is still so cheap. Even people, I've had this phone for 6 years. It cost me $1,000. It should last longer than 6 years. I was like, you've had it in your hand for 3 hours a day for 6 years. The average price of a car in America is like $52,000 now. And you're complaining about a $700 phone that you use way more than your car? That is amazing. Amazing in every possible way, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
That you can measure. I don't know. We're in a weird place, I guess is what it is. I don't know. Do you think though that for you, you could detach from all of it and just say, just ignore all of it? And just,
I ignore much of it. I do ignore much of it. I don't read the news much anymore. I've deleted all social media apps except Substack. I largely try to stay out of it because I got to a point where, I mean, not to be overly dramatic, but it was just too hard to function.
Sure.
There were, and I think maybe that was by design from the powers that be. And I think it still is to a certain degree, but I had to pull away.
Sure.
Because I just found it affecting me You know, it's like the vape pen thing. It shouldn't have been as big a deal as it was, but the way you and I are wired, it was a big deal, and it was the way it was. And I still don't have the tools to reconcile all of the things that are going on and be functional. So I have to limit or minimize, you know, how much I see on a daily basis. If there's something, you know, important or you know, somebody like Adrian will send me something and go, yeah, you really should take a look at this, or we'll talk about it. But I'm trying not to volunteer so much time to the echo chamber.
Sure. Do you think that if you almost imagined yourself on a desert island and just do what you're going to do, make what you're going to make, whatever it is, and to hell with what comes back in any regard.
Yeah.
That's probably the best way to do it.
You know, that's a good question. And it's something, there's something analogous to that, that I've been wrestling with and, you know, and just pulling away from all of it and just living my life and writing about it and documenting myself, trying to go through it and understand it and make sense of it all.
Yeah.
And that's it. And
Ralph
leave
Waldo
the other stuff.
Sidoris.
Right. Get a little cabin. No. You know, and I think I've had to shift the motivations. I think I've had to look at the motivations and realize that there are things that I just enjoy doing. Like I really do enjoy painting and making things. And I've had to do a lot of internal work on getting back to the joy of those things for their own sake, not looking at some sort of return on it. And I understand that that's from a place of enormous privilege, and that's not lost on me. It's not wasted on me. But I can't continue to beat myself up over imagined failings that aren't my fault or within my control anyway.
Sure. Sure. I think that's where some of the anxiety in society in general is that so much of it is something we cannot control at all.
100%. Yeah, I agree.
And it's just like, great. So now I'm just riding. I'm on this ride and I have no control over where it goes and I have no control of how any of it affects me. And even the things that I think that I have control of in my own life, I don't really, because there's so many larger externalities that can just dwarf whatever effort I'm putting in.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it really does elevate the idea of dumb luck. I mean, there is so much I know in my own life, many of the best things that have happened to me in my life are not a result of anything that I did directly other than put myself in the path of that thing. And sure, maybe even that wasn't intentional.
Yep.
But honestly, the best things in my life have come out of happenstance or right place, right time, you know, and conversely, many of the things that I thought would go well, be big hits, be successful, they weren't successful in the ways that I, at the time, wanted them to be, but the long tail of it has brought me joy that I couldn't have seen coming or interest or curiosity that I couldn't have planned on my best day.
Sure.
So I do think it's a matter of shifting expectations. Expectation management has been a huge focus for me in therapy lately. And trying to let go of, I should be able to, you know, control every little thing. You know, it's back to that thing that you mentioned about perfection. You have to let go of that because it only exists in your mind, I believe.
Yeah. I think it's a little bit like the Arthur C. Clarke, you know, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. I think there are people who you see who you think are perfect because they're good at what they do, but I'm sure they see the same imperfections in themselves that you see in yourself. It's just that, you know, they're just further along the line than you are or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Maybe they have better tools to both internalize and externalize those feelings. And yeah. and that's, you know, speaking for myself, that's what I'm trying to work on is the moderation of those poles. So it's not, I'm not between positive negative 100 all the time. Maybe it's positive negative 25. Maybe it's positive negative 12 and a half.
Yeah, it's hard. The gray, right? Black and yeah. white is way easier than gray.
Yeah.
It really is. I mean, it's just.
Yeah,
it is. I hate the idea that there is a soup of reasons why things are the way they are, and it's not just one thing or two things or three things. It's 47 things in different weights, and shift the weights in one direction or the other, and the whole thing topples in a different direction.
Yeah. And you may not even be aware of all 47 things. You think you are, but you aren't.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's been one of my downfalls is thinking that I have more control or agency than I actually do, and learning how to respond, not simply react.
Sure. Yeah. By the way, when I yelled at that guy, I didn't even know what I was doing. Like,
oh,
I was
sure.
inside myself watching somebody else do it.
I'm sure. Because you were, from what I know of you, you were still stuck in, and I don't mean stuck, like couldn't get out of it, but you were still in the feels of how that hit you. So the reaction was almost, is it autonomic? Is that what that is?
Yeah. I don't know. Like, it's just another person. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. Totally.
I've been there. I'm there all the time.
He's like, I'm there right there. I'm right.
Yeah.
Right
and then, now. And then somebody goes, you know, kind of, you know, rattles you back into the present and you go, oh my God. Yeah. That was not the way to go. I should have made a different choice there. Could have made a different choice there.
Yeah. Could have made a different choice there.
Yeah.
But you know, it's so, you know, maybe it's, I don't know, making different choices in everything we do. You know, my mother started.
Hard to do in real time though, man. Oh, it's hard to do in real time.
It's so hard. I mean, maybe it's just slow. Well, listen, I didn't scream at the guy at the theater. I asked politely and sternly.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, but maybe if that had happened without the guy the day before, I would have yelled at the guy at the theater. Maybe I learned a lesson.
It's a good way to look at it. You know, as Adrian says all the time, it all counts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. You started to say something.
No, I know. It doesn't matter. We'll talk about it another time.
All right.
My mother started painting.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Good for her.
It started with lots and lots of paint by numbers. But then
nothing wrong with that.
But then occasionally she runs out of paint by numbers and she started painting.
That's fantastic.
Last year she sent us a paint by numbers version of a Kandinsky that she called a Sindinsky.
Nice. That's good. I like
and
that.
It's up on our wall. And I just, you know, it's like I look at my mother and it's just like, you know, one day she was sending me something, it was like a, you know, flowers in a vase, still life kind of thing. And I was like, it's good. I said, have you tried adding some white highlights on like that side of those leaves to like give it some dimensionality? She's like, I don't know what you mean. And so I like sent her a picture that had some highlights on it. And then like 10 minutes later, she sends me another picture where she tried to add some white highlights on like one of the leaves. And I was like, yeah, that's it. Like just, you know, she's like, it doesn't look right. I was like, well, it's the first time you ever did it. Like, it's not going
to
be
perfect. You're still trying to wrestle with the concept of why they exist, why those highlights are there.
Exactly. You know, and it's
let yourself off the hook.
And I, you know, I said to her something along the lines of like, you see the feeling you're getting right now where it's like two steps forward and one step back. And she's like, yeah, I said, that's the feeling that people like me chase for the last 40 something years.
Yeah.
That like, oh, I'm getting better at this. Oh crap. It's not as good as I want it to be. Oh, I'm getting better at this. Oh, it's not as good as I want it to be. That is like the artist's life right there in a nutshell. And that unknown, that frustration, it's like, I have to try to make it better, but I know I might make it worse in the process. But in making it worse, I will notice that the thing I started with wasn't as good as I thought it was.
Yeah. I mean, and those decisions around it are hard.
Yeah.
They're, you know, I think I told you in building these plugins, at one point, the AI tells me, it doesn't feel like you're making any decisions. It says, it feels like you're just engineering around complexity.
I'm sorry, were you on Bill Wadman.ai? Because that was me actually talking.
And I was like, the nerve. But then I was like, you're right.
How I'm dare not. You? Okay. Yeah. Okay, I'll give you you're this right. one.
But it was absolutely true. Yep. I was just creating option upon option upon option upon option and not making decisions about what I wanted, what I thought was good, in quotes, what I thought would be the right, again, in quotes, choice.
Sure.
I was just leaving it all up to the user. And it was, man, it cut, but it was absolutely spot on. And I ended up starting from scratch and going in a completely different direction and making decisions. And I think the end result is immeasurably better. And it really did give me this sort of little boost of like, oh, I can make decisions. Like I'm a big boy now. Yeah. You know, I can make decisions.
I'm glad that a machine full of numbers can tell you this. I've been telling you this for 358.90 episodes.
It is true. It's true. It's
like, I don't know how that makes me feel.
Yeah. Yeah. Wait a minute.
So, Bill, I have this new friend called Claude, and he told me.
That's right.
Just to start things and keep going.
Yeah.
And hey, you want to go have lunch? That's a good idea, Claudie.
I don't know. I'm going to ask Claude. Yeah.
Wait, one last thing. Yeah. Do you have a preferred one you play with?
Yeah. And in fact, I think ChatGPT, which friend of the show, Richard Boutwell, has coined Chatty G.
Okay.
Which I think is great. I think ChatGPT is better for sort of language and you know, quote unquote, humanistic kind of responses. Whereas Claude is much better at nuts and bolts coding and explaining my experience, explaining why it's making those decisions and explaining things along the way so I can understand a little better.
Yeah.
Yeah, that has been okay. My experience.
Yeah. I mean, I tend to go to Claude if I'm going to play with any of them.
Yeah.
I don't know, for reasons. I don't know what the good reasons are. I don't know if there are any good reasons for any of this stuff. I feel guilty about it still sometimes, but
I do too. I do too.
You know, you can't get left behind, Jeffrey.
Well, and that was the thing, right? As I just wanted to do an experiment and go, is there something in here for me? I know there's something in there for lots of people, but is there something in there for me?
Yeah.
And in a very, very small sort of niche slice, yeah, in this particular case, it made something possible that I couldn't have done on my own.
Yep.
But in terms of the visual side that you and I talked about earlier, I don't see it doing anything that I am not able to do. It'll do it faster, and it may do it may iterate on it more, you know, efficiently or in ways that I didn't think of. But the visual side, like you, is where I get so much joy that sure. I don't want to let AI into my joy.
Yep.
In that respect.
Yep. Yeah. There's new tools in Capture One. There's like retouching tools in Capture One. That lets you like blemish stuff and dark circles and stuff. Like there's a slider that you can kind of like retouch teeth a little bit and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And used judiciously, it's super handy.
Yeah.
But you can easily overdo it. But like if you're just doing some pictures for somebody or whatever it is, it's like, am I going to let this thing do some of the work for me? Yeah. If it's not something that's important and somebody's not paying me a lot of money to do it, sure. You know what I mean?
And maybe you're short on time. I don't have 6 hours to retouch this thing by hand.
Or people want me to retouch 30 of these. I'm not going to retouch 30
of them.
But I'll do this for 30 of them. You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. Time will tell where this all comes out, Jeffrey.
I believe that's true.
All right. You got anything you want to promote while we're at it?
No. Do we want to do we have a photographer of the week?
You know, it's funny. I hadn't thought of one, although I think I could, wait. Where I did have one. Hold on a second. Who was I obsessed with this last week? Did we ever do Helen Levitt?
Gosh, I can't imagine that we didn't. But that's a fantastic choice. If not,
man, I was looking at some of her pictures. There's these couple pictures where these kids are wearing these creepy masks climbing trees. Do you know these pictures?
No, hold on. Real time.
You're about to be freaked out. Here, I'm sending you a link. This is like something out of Slender Man horror films. I don't know why, but this picture freaks me out. But I also
I don't need to see that. Yeah, that's
it's a nightmare, right?
Nightmare I don't need fuel. To, that's why are they what is it that they're wearing?
I don't know. Okay,
would you include this shot?
Yeah, I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, this is Helen Levitt, a terrific photographer. Why not? Yeah, I don't know if we've done her or not.
Died in only 2009. She was 1913 to 2009. But it seems like a lot of her work that people know was, you know, late Great Depression, 40s. You know what I mean? She was in that sort of era. It was the stuff that like a lot of people talk about. But cool street photography. And then she gets into the color stuff in the 50s.
I think her color stuff is fantastic.
I do too.
But this is another discussion. There's a quality to her color.
Okay.
That may be a byproduct of the film stock and that's part of it. But I was reading this article the other day, and maybe we can talk about this another time, where how color has vanished from modern society. If you look at clothing, if you look at cars, if you look at decor, color has been, everything has been muted. Everything is sort of a tint of black, white, or gray.
Sure.
And we've lost these bright colors. Like look at fashion in even in the 80s and 90s versus now.
Yep.
So I think there's some interesting stuff around her color. And it's interesting to see people, photographers who are primarily known for black and white, to see their color work. I saw Winogrand's color work. Some of his color. And I was like, wait, Winogrand shot color? Yeah. Like it was just, you don't think about it because you're so used to seeing
it was on
that body 6, of black and white.
6,000 of the roles he never processed before.
Yeah, right.
you know, it's funny. I was watching, I was on the rower the other day and I was like, I just want to, there's a Eggleston show going on right now. It's like the last Die Prince or whatever it is.
Oh, really? In New York?
Yeah. And they're 20 by 24 Die prints, and they start at $80,000 a piece. So I will not be buying one.
Wow!
But I want to go see them. Matt, my buddy Matt Carr went to see him last week, and he's like, yeah, I might go again this week, so I might go with him.
Where is it?
David Zwimmer, one of those places. Stone Last Dies.
Huh. Will you put a link in it? In
David
notes,
Zwimmer,
please.
Zwirmner. I can never.
How long is it going to be there?
It's there until March 7th.
Well, if the snow ever melts, it would be fun to get up and see you.
Yeah, it's definitely. I remember going to see a show of his, a lot of die prints at the Whitney in like 2005, 2006. It was one of the best photo shows I've ever seen. They looked like they were backlit by you know, boxes, light boxes.
Oh, wow. Like on a Duralar sheet or something?
Yeah, they were absolutely beautiful. They just sat there and it's just
here we go. David Zwirner Gallery, The Last Dies, an exhibition highlighting new die transfer prints by the artist, opens at our 19th Street Gallery in New York on Thursday, January 15th.
I mean, he is not he's 86 years old. He's not a young man.
Wow.
It's not a bad idea. If they were $10,000, I would try to put together the money and buy one.
Yeah, but 80 grand, man, that's a big...
Imagine how cool it would be to own an Eggleston die transfer print. Come on, that would be awesome.
It would be pretty epic, yeah. Yeah, it would be pretty epic.
Apparently, you can buy some of like the lesser-known images, die transfers. You can get them for $10,000-$15,000 on the market, open market.
Or you can buy a book.
Or you can buy a book, which I did in 2006, which is sitting on my shelf. But anyway, back to Helen Levitt. But her color stuff is absolutely beautiful. And of a very particular time, you know, early 70s, some places in New York, a lot of, you know, black neighborhoods and stuff like that, like in just the colors and the people are so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very, very, very cool stuff. Very, but the early stuff is super creepy, and then it becomes much more like normal street stuff to me, but not in a bad way, just in a, you know, I think it's maybe just because the old stuff is just, it feels like another time, where the stuff in the 50s and the 60s, it like feels like another time, but another time that like that could actually still be the corner around the corner from me.
Yeah.
Living That's in cool. New York. People, when men still wore hats, you remember that.
I do.
You're old enough to have worn a hat, right?
I'm wearing one right now.
All right, Jeffrey. I will talk to you later.
All right, my friend. Thanks for this.
All right, we'll see
thanks
you
for soon. Listening, everybody.
All right, bye.
See ya.
This way.